Welcome back to readaboutit.com. Reed Kerr here with you. Another podcast today. Thanks for coming back to the website. Today's podcast, a special pleasure for me. I got to sit down with one of my idols, award-winning writer Joe R. Lansdale, who, in addition to bearing the burden of being my personal idol, is also a guy who's been published dozens and dozens of times in every way, shape, and form pretty much for decades now. Novels, short stories, novellas, articles. He's written everything. He wrote the story that became Bubba Hotep, which I know people who come to my website love that movie. He's done it all. And on top of all that, he's still a hell of a nice guy who would take time to talk to me and to other aspiring writers and give tips. So that's one of the reasons that I sat down with him to get all these things down. I ask him all sorts of questions in this interview. A couple of highlights here. I ask him, do you need an agent?
One that irritates me is, you know, how do I get an agent? Have you got a book? No. Then don't worry about an agent.
Right.
You know, write the book.
He's got some strong words about e-publishing. I mean, not as a supplement to regular publishing, but people just who don't go the route of getting an editor and going through a publisher. He says you need that.
I think that that's part of what makes you the writer you are. And I think that's part of what, you know, allows you to earn that position and be proud.
And finally, Joe gives one tip in this interview. It's about 40 minutes long. He gives one tip, and he says this about cleaning up your writing, just for this one thing that he gives you.
You know, it's such an obvious distraction from what they were saying, and what it makes me feel, and usually I'm right, not always, is they didn't write the scene well enough to begin with, so therefore they're trying to give you some clue as to what they meant.
Okay, so Joe R. Lansdale today here at readaboutit.com. Thanks to Joe for sitting down and talking with me. And that's actually how I started the interview, just thanking him for being nice. And being, you know, extremely easy to talk to writer.
I don't think it has anything to do with being a writer. I think it just has to do with basic personality. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I grew up, my mother was easy to talk to, and we did a lot of talking at home, and I just learned to do that. And our whole family is pretty much like that.
Mm-hmm. Very easy to get along. Let me talk about your process first, and then I'll ask you about some of the things that, some of the tips you've been giving.
Sure, anything.
Let me just start with this. You write a lot. You write a lot of things.
I do write.
A lot of different areas. How many projects do you normally have going at a time?
I usually have one major project, but there is usually a small project in the background. Like right now I'm writing a short story. Actually, it's for my daughter for an anthology she's editing for Subterranean Press. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, I have an introduction to Night of the Hunter by Davis Grubb that I'm doing for a special edition. But I'm rereading the book and thinking about it and not really doing it real consciously. I'm not a very conscious sort of guy in the way mm-hmm. I approach things, whether it be articles or anything like that, unless I have to look up a specific fact or something like that. I want to be accurate. But I have usually one major project and then one minor project that's in the back wings. Then I always have like two or three things that are in my machine that I just go into and touch until something takes fire. Mm-hmm. Then it gets pulled to the front.
So if you've got a major project you're working on, if you just kind of get tired of that or something, then you kind of rotate to the other.
Yeah, I mean, even once in a while, even if I have a novel contract and I have a novel project, I will occasionally stop somewhere. I'll get to a point where I feel like I want to stop, and I might write a short story, or I might work on an introduction, or you know, some other piece of work. Mm-hmm. I also write the occasional article. That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. How many ideas do you have percolating at any given
time? I don't have any given number. I mean, sometimes mm-hmm. it'll be a lot more than others. I don't really, I'm not somebody that thinks specifically about things. I know that's vague, mm-hmm. but I tend to have, if I get something started, I will return to it. Sometimes I'll even forget I started it, and I'll go through my files and go, oh, I didn't even know I started that. I might find 30 pages on it and not even remember writing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so when I get that mood, I work, and sometimes when I rediscover something I'm working on by rereading it, I'll find the energy to finish it. I just did a story called Wrestling Jesus for Gardner Dussois and George R.R. Martin for an anthology called Dangerous Women, and mine is actually about a Mexican wrestler named Jesus. But it's also a kind of an odd story. But that story, the beginning of it had been lying around for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, I'd go in and touch it, and I'd nudge it a sentence. I'd nudge it two sentences. Then I'd go back and work on whatever I was doing, my 3 to 5 pages a day. And then I'd go back to it again. And then one day when it caught fire, I finished it.
Is that what your 3 to 5 pages, is that the output you shoot for?
The best way I know how to tell you is that I plan on getting at least 3 to 5 pages a day. Mm-hmm. It's rare when I don't, and it's often when I get more. But if I have that small goal in mind, I'm a hero every day. That way I know I'm probably going to accomplish that. And then at the end of, and I'm very careful when I do it, so that at the end of the week, whether I work 5 days or 7 days, I know I'm going to have, you know, at worst, I'm going to have maybe 15 pages. If I have a really big day, I might have 25, or, I mean, really big week. If I do 7 days a week, more. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's almost like having anywhere from 20 to 30 pages a week near finished copy.
Right. Tell me a little bit about the creative process that you go through. Say that you're writing a novel. Say you're writing something long form. How much do you have it planned out ahead of time? Do you timeline it? Do you script it? Do you just go from what's in your head? How do you plan around
long form? You know, I've never plotted anything except when I first began and I had such disastrous results with it. And I would get so bored with it, or I would feel like I'd already written it, that I quit plotting in that strict sense. I think everybody plots subconsciously.
Right.
But I will just go to bed the next morning, I'll get up, it's there, I'll write it, it's gone, I don't think about the rest of the day, I'll go to bed, I'll get up the next morning, it's there again. It's mm-hmm. just like a gift from the gods most of the time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I go in and it's like pulling teeth.
When you go to bed with a project like that, do you know when you walk away from the table what you will start with the next day?
I mean, if I've ended a scene somewhere, I might already have an inkling of where that scene is going to start the next day, but I'm not always sure where it's going. Now and again, you just wear out, but you have enough energy to know where the scene is the next day. So sometimes that's even easier. You just get up the next day and you start that scene. But I usually find if I don't overwork a day, then I have enough energy the next day that the scene I was thinking about has a tremendous amount of energy itself, and therefore the reader feels that energy. And if it doesn't, I might lose the energy myself. The reader may not feel that energy. It doesn't always work that smooth.
And you're consciously aware of the energy in your scenes, of what's driving them.
I always tell people that I think less about plot as I think about rhythm. And for me, it's almost like music. It's like it must be more like how a musician does when they hear something in their head. Yeah. Not lyrics necessarily, just music. And somewhere along the line, I feel sort of like the beat gets right, the rhythm gets right, and if that first sentence doesn't come smoothly and I have to keep working with it, it won't catch fire until it really begins to have a sort of rhythm, a sort of smoothness, a sort of style, and then the characters emerge from that. And I'm strange in that way, that I tend to write more out of mood, and the mood becomes the characters, becomes the story. It's like my friend Lou Shiner says, he says, when I have that kind of sensation, I research. When I have that kind of sensation, I start writing. So everybody's different.
You talk about it in music. It sounds very much like jazz.
Yeah, I think so. It's funny because I'm not what I would call a real fan of jazz. I like the old kind of jazz and stuff. But when you think about it as a creative writing process, it's very much like jazz. It's like riffing. Mm-hmm. And I find the characters as I go. I start writing, and I occasionally there's the pure craft that will kick in. I'll say, there's not enough here for me to know who this person is. So I will go back and I will apply myself to that particular problem. But I'm sure that I'm doing it in the subconscious, but I rarely use the conscious mind, because as soon as I do, I just get a headache. It's like the more I think about it, it's not fun and it loses its energy. And I find that some people say, well, it isn't supposed to always be fun. And I will agree with that. It's not. And sometimes it's not fun. I've written novels that were no fun at all. Short stories that were no fun at all turned out to be some of the best things I ever wrote. I've written things that were tremendous fun that were not the best I've ever written. But for me, I'm looking for that fun. And so I at least have this pleasant feeling. And, I will go down some stairs sometimes, and in 30 minutes I've written my 5 pages, and I'm through for the day. And then other days it'll be 3 hours. But it's very rarely ever over that. And if it goes over that, I'm not going to get it that day. I'm just going to quit. Mm-hmm. Then the next day I go in, I might get 6 or 7.
You talk about trying to find that rhythm.
Right.
How much detail when you write is, how much of that comes from what's inside your head, and how much of it comes from picking up the rhythm of your characters as the story
both.
Goes on?
It's a combination of both. I mean, a lot of what you put in is, I'm not trying to give you the impression that I'm pulling this out of the air. I'm just saying that I'm not as conscious of it. It's subconscious. And I imagine as I walk around every day, I know that, because it'll be somebody who will say something, or I'll hear something, I'll read something, I will view something, hear something on the radio, or hear something in music, or a conversation, and it'll stick with me. And I may just get that one line out of it, but that one line will create 2 lines, which I guess would be a lot like writing a song or writing poetry. Right. You write one line, and it finds a second line. And so for me, the ideas are everywhere. I don't ever stop and think, where do I get my ideas? The problem is I got too many.
How do you save them? Do you jot them down? Do you just put them away in your head for later? Or?
I once in a while, I will jot something on the back of the envelope, lose it, and never find it again. So it really doesn't seem to matter. But what I find though is that the actual process of saying I passed a road that said Dead Man's Road, there's a story there. That might be the only thing I have, but I'll write it down. But once I write it down, it'll go in the head, and if it's worth it, it'll return. And that's my belief. That's what I came to. If it's not worth it, it's not worth digging out. Sometimes I'll have a story idea, and it's like I was telling you, I'll go in and I'll say, you know what? I've got a feeling here, and I'll write like a opening sentence or a paragraph or a page or two or three, and then it's, I know that feeling isn't completely pregnant, so to speak. And when I do that, I'll have a piece of the story, and I can leave it, go away, and that's one of those that I put on the back burner. And, you know, I was going through some stuff the other day and found, well, it's been a while back, and I found two complete stories I didn't even remember writing until I started reading them, and I realized, oh, okay, I just meant to go back and draft these. But I was probably writing those part-time while I was writing the main story, and so I wrote both of those and sold both of them, you know? I just polished them up, and they were good stories.
When you talk about that polish, do you write and then read and then rewrite, or do you wait for the end to go back over?
Well, it's not always a completely consistent system. You know, it's what people always, when you tell them something, they want it to be absolutely always consistent. But what it means is that my method is, for the most part, I get up in the morning, I write 3 to 5 pages, I polish that 3 to 5 pages as best I can that day. And with a few exceptions, once in a while it'll just come to me and I'll just feel it's right and I'm going to leave it. But the next morning, no matter what I wrote, I reread the last bit that I wrote, whether it was 3 pages or 5 pages or 10 pages or 15, and then I polish that as I go and then start the next 3 pages. And so it's kind of a 3 pages, polish, 3 more, polish, 3 more. It's a polish 3 more every day, you know, except the first day, which is write and polish.
Right. You talk about getting up in the morning and you write in the mornings.
Right.
And this is something that you have, that writers have to have. You know, it's a creative process, but you have to be disciplined with
right.
it. Do you think, you know, of course, we're here in your dojo.
Right.
You know, you're a highly accomplished martial artist also. Is that something discipline-wise that helps you stay on track?
Absolutely. Martial arts does that. Even as I get older and when I get, you know, I'm 60 now and I get 70, I get 80, if I'm still around, I may not even be as physically able, but what it is, what it's done is that as long as I'm physically and mentally able, it's taught me that discipline. The discipline, a real martial arts goes well beyond self-defense. It's got a lot more to it. And I'm not talking about your McDojos where, you run kids through and get all their money and then move on to another crop of kids and hand out black belts to children. I don't do that. But to me, that discipline is absolutely the most important thing. But there's also this, is once you teach yourself that discipline, that at least for me, once I reached the level to where I had the discipline, then I was having so much fun. At first, it's not as fun because you're a little, you know, you're not used to handling words or you're wary of where to go and after that. But after a while, as you gain confidence, another aspect of martial arts, you begin to have so much fun that it's such a part of you that every once in a while when I do take off or I'm gone somewhere, I start feeling kind of, you know, down. I need to work. I like doing it. So it's like my wife says you have to do it. That's what you do.
That's what I do.
That's who I am. It's not all of who I am. It's just a piece of who I am, but it's an important piece. Mm-hmm. I always think of myself as not an obsessed writer, but a passionate writer. I think it's different. I think obsession gets to be almost like the stalker. I have some friends I know that write 14, 15 hours every day and have lunch at their desk and more power to them. But for me, no, not me. I want to get my 3 or 4 or 5. I got books to read. I got martial arts to practice. I've got movies to see. I want to hang with my family. I need to go drink coffee. I need to visit. So for me, all of that actually makes me a better writer. But I'm consistent and I show up. It's not how many hours you work, it's how well you work doing those hours. You know, if I work more than that most of the time, I get diminishing returns. There are times when I will just have this urge to work another session and I'll do it. I don't fight it. And sometimes I've done 9, 10, 12 hours in a day. Sometimes when I
but
just
only
felt
when you feel like
only
it's
when I feel yeah. like it, or you know, there's been times when I'd gotten behind and I needed to catch up that I forced myself to push a little farther. There's been times when this things happened in life that kept you from being at the table or at your desk doing your work. You know, I had a flood at the house and I was like, I actually had board over rafters and was writing on that, and I wrote still, and during that time, I was using my money to repair the house because the insurance was going very, very slowly. And I just saw my bank account going down like, you know, $65,000, $70,000. I'm going, holy cow. So I was turning out a story almost a day, some of the best I've ever written, won awards and was in best of the year books and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So your mind is more facile than you think.
Right.
You know?
You have your rhythm down. And like you said, but that frees you up for the rest of the day to teach and to be around.
Yeah, to have life. And I also teach at the university. I'm writer in residence at SFA. I don't have a degree, but I have an experience, and that's what they're paying me for is experience. So I teach one semester a year. I did teach two semesters at first, but now I generally teach either spring or fall semester. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I enjoy that too. I get out and I get invigorated by the kids and seeing them trying to get excited about it. Because back when I first started, you very seldom ever had a creative writing course with anybody that ever wrote anything.
Oh, yeah.
Unless it was a poem about a tree or something or some, you know, dreadful story about two people having trouble with their marriage in Connecticut, you know, and I'm not saying those can't be good, they can, but generally it was the same thing over and over, and I didn't want to take a class from people like that, so I never took any creative writing classes.
Mm-hmm. When you are able to do that, that also helps feed your writing because as you said, does. You get inspiration and you
relearn stuff. I mean, as soon as you start thinking, you know, I feel that I've learned confidence and I've learned that I feel that I'm facile enough with words, but I never think I know it because what happens with these kids, as soon as I said, you know, I've been doing this for a long time and there's a better way of doing it, and I learned it from trying to teach this person how to do it, or something that person said taught me something. So it continues all the time.
You, like I said, you've written a lot of things, a lot mm-hmm. of different genres, a lot of different mm-hmm. novels, short stories, all of that. Mm-hmm. When you write, do you write with how it's going to be published in mind?
To some extent I do, meaning this, I mean, a lot of times when I'm just writing a story on my own, you know, or a novel, I don't think about it much. But when I'm, like if I've got a deal for write crime novels, there's going to be a crime element in it. But I don't feel stuck to and structured by that crime element. Mm-hmm. And the same way as like I do a lot of short stories, like Gardner Dussewa comes to me and says, I want you to write a story and the title's Dangerous Women. Okay. So I write a story about a Mexican wrestler. But it has in its background a woman that ruined his life. So in a sense, I'm still writing and fulfilling that idea, but it's not as direct. I don't tend to do it on the nose all the time. Sometimes it's perfect. You hear something, you say, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. Sometimes I want to go pulp. Sometimes I want to go literary. I always want to write well. I mean, literary to me just means writing well. Mm-hmm. I've been published in literary magazines that are some of the lowest common denominator. I've done novels when I was starting out for, you know, smaller companies, larger companies. I mean, I was with Knopf and Vintage for nearly 9 years. I'm now with Little Brown, Mulholland actually is a branch mm-hmm. of it. So Doubleday. So I've always just sort of, you know, the money just kind of shows up. And I keep selling them the films. I write screenplays. I do comics. You know, and it's like I do it for the love, but I also do it to get paid. I have to make a living doing it. And there are some people say, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to prostitute for my art. And yet they would work some job they hate and do that. If they can make a living writing and don't, then that's prostitution.
Really?
I'm having a good time. And if I've picked something sometimes where I had to make a living with it, I don't put a sack over its head and do it for old glory. I'm always trying to find what's me. And some of the best and most original work, things I'm the proudest of, I did them because I thought, well, I've got to write something now. But that doesn't mean I don't care. A good writer is a good writer.
Right. One of the things that you're a big fan of, and you've posted this a lot on Facebook, is reading. As a writer, you have to read, don't you?
Absolutely. All the time. You know, and it doesn't always matter. Well, it does matter what you read, but it doesn't matter the type of thing you read. I mean, if you read nothing but bad romance novels of a factory or adventure novels or science fiction, I mean, I don't care. You can take any genre or literary magazines that are crummy. It doesn't matter what you're reading. If you're not getting something that's stimulating and that's well done, it doesn't do you any good. But I don't have this sort of thing where I say, oh, this is beneath me. I want to read. If it appeals to me, I read it. And sometimes I just say, well, you know, a lot of people like this. I'm curious about it. Sometimes I find I don't like it, I can't finish it. Other times I'm surprised at how much I do like it. And sometimes it's something that's really very literary and very deep, and then other times it'll be something that I just had a good time with. But I learned some aspect from every one of those, and it's like putting fuel in the tank. It's like constantly putting gasoline in the tank, perpetual motion.
Is there anything, any goal that you've got? Is there something you'd like to do that you haven't done yet? some genre or something you'd like to still break into?
I think more of my goals are there's a big Western that I've been working on, off and on, in pieces. I've written some stuff and published it as short stories. But I know there's a Western there, and this was one of those where I do know kind of what it's about since I've written parts of it, but I don't know what it's completely about. And I feel like when that moment comes, it will come, and it's getting nearer, you know?
Yeah.
And I probably want to do a book on the martial arts, a nonfiction book. I've been asked to do a memoir. I don't know if I'm ever going to do that actually or not. But some of those things I think about. There's a comic book that I would like to create, a certain comic book, and do it on my own and then try to go out and market it. Mm-hmm. And, I think there's an original screenplay that I would like to write. I've written several screenplays, but there are a few little things in the background. But I have to say I'm very fortunate that if I died tomorrow, I don't feel defeated or wasted, or I've had such a good time. And I have a good life.
If we had to write up your resume, what would you want at the top of it? What are the favorite things that you've done that you're proudest of?
Husband and father, really. Yeah. Sincerely, I know people say that, but I mean it. I mean, my kids, I'm so proud of them. My marriage, I've been married 38 years. My wife and I married when we were 21. We started out plowing with mules, and I wrote part-time. She worked at a place where they packed meat into a freezer, and then I worked as a janitor, and then she worked as a police and fire dispatcher. And so we did all kinds of things like that. And now she works for me, and I get to do what I thought I wanted to do ever since I was 9 years old, write and do martial arts. Martial arts came more like when I was 11.
Was there something that you read that made you want to write? I mean, I know you read a lot of things.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I started reading I could read well before I even went to first grade, mm-hmm. you know. I read comics originally. That was the most important thing I read was comic books. And I read every kind of superhero comic book. I read every other kind of funny animal comic book, anything they had. We called them funny books. And but the first fiction I remember, And when I was very young, I read Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book, The Iliad, and The Odyssey by Homer. And then when I read Edgar Rice Burroughs' A Princess of Mars, I already knew I wanted to be a writer. But when I read that, I had to be one.
Let me talk about the advice that you're getting. A lot of people, you're very approachable, as we said. I would assume that to anyone else that wants to write, your first advice is always to read and to keep reading.
Right.
Whatever it is, whether it's what you want to write or just anything of decent enough quality.
Yeah, I think it's important to find what you want to write first and then to branch out to make what you want to write more varied and interesting. You know, I set out to write science fiction, and then somewhere in the mid-70s, in my 20s, I was already reading all kinds of stuff, but I really went wild reading all kinds of different kinds of fiction, and I realized I didn't just want to write that. I wanted to write all kinds of things. My advice to people, first, read.
What kind of common questions do you get? I know a lot of people want to know how to get into.
Well, the people always ask about an agent, which in one way kind of irritates me. There's people that say they get irritated about where do you get your ideas. That one doesn't irritate me. Mm-hmm. One that irritates me is, you know, how do I get an agent? Have you got a book? No. Then don't worry about an agent.
Right.
You know, write the book. And then as about far as getting an agent, nothing wrong with that. The field has changed a lot. It's important to have one. But it's harder to get one if you don't have the work. And, you know, if that shouldn't be your only goal, is trying to get an agent after you've written something. You should continue to write more stuff, because eventually you will get that agent, or you will, if you sell something short, it gives you an opening to sell another piece, and then that gives you an opening to get an agent for the novel.
So the shorter work is
important to get to the longer piece. And I'm fully aware that there are some people who are not inclined towards short work, and so that's not a route for them. And in that case, you know, a lot of times I still think that you can sell novels without an agent. It's just harder. But I'm nothing against you getting one. I'm merely saying how difficult it is to get one. Mm-hmm. And if that becomes your only goal or only method, it may take you a while. But write the books, then try to get an agent. You write a good book, you're more likely to get a good agent than if you just say, I want an agent and I'm thinking about writing and here's a proposal. That's not going to happen.
You're never going to get
it. It's never going to happen.
Did you start with an agent?
No. I sold articles in 1970. I was 21. I sold the first thing I ever wrote. I wrote with my mother, and we wrote it under a pen name, her name. Actually, I wrote it. She gave me the idea, and I wrote a little article, and it won a prize, and I just started writing articles, and I sold every one of them. And then I said, well, I'm going to write fiction, which is what I want to do, and then it took me two and a half years to start selling fiction. And then once I did that, I just kept writing them, and the way I did it is I mailed them in. And they, when they didn't accept them, they mailed them back with a rejection. And I just kept doing that. Because that's the days of mail, not email. Now we email stories a lot of the time, most of the time. But I just kept doing that. And then when 1980, I wrote 2.5 novels in 1 year because I was young and very energetic. Mm-hmm. And I wrote those 2.5 novels, and I got an agent on the basis of the short story sales. And that agent turned out to be terrible, but I eventually sold the novel, and then I fired that agent, and I fired 6 or 7 in the process. One of them I fired, a very prominent agent, a good one, who says, we can't identify what you're doing. We can't put you in a box, and you need to do that. And I says, no, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's, we'll just call it a day. And I went on, sold that novel, The Night Runners, and it did real well for me overall. And it just, you know, things just kept building, and then it was easier for me to get an agent. They started writing me and asking me to sign up with them.
It sounds like it's better to have no agent than to have the wrong agent.
A bad agent can do you a lot of harm. A good agent can do you a lot of good. Even now, I have a book agent who handles all of my novels that are done for the mainstream press, handles all of my foreign sales, and then I have a film agent that handles my film business. But I handle all of the novels or short stories that I write for small press. Overseas, he handles some of those. I handle some. I handle all of my nonfiction articles. I handle all my comic books. So I keep my hand in, too, right, so that it keeps me a little bit more alert and aware of what's going on.
When a writer starts out, they have to develop their own style. A lot of people, right, are kind of protective of that style. How do you know sometimes when your style is hurting you? You've thrown out some things as far as your writing tips. Some things that I've noticed in my work and some other work, like for example, you said there's no reason to use a word, any word other than the word said.
Yeah.
You don't like that.
Yeah.
I haven't
always done that, by the way. I mean, when I started out, I did just like everybody else, mm-hmm, because that's what I was seeing in a lot of books. And I'm not trying to tell you not to do it.
Right.
I'm saying I don't like it. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that most things read better without it. Because when you say, you know, as people, he growled, so-and-so, growl that sentence for me. He grunted. Grunt me a sentence. You know,
right.
Some of that stuff just doesn't. It may just be me, but when I hear that, I think, you know, it's such an obvious distraction from what they were saying. And what it makes me feel, and usually I'm right, not always, is they didn't write the scene well enough to begin with. So therefore, they're trying to give you some clue as to what they meant.
Right.
I would rather not know than either rewrite the sentence or rewrite the scene to make it better. Because if you have to identify it all the time, and people say, well, you have to. I say, well, look at Hemingway. Look at James Cain. You know, those are two examples. There are plenty of others, but those are two great examples. Now, there are writers I love that do that all the time. They use the said-isms. Ray Bradbury, Raymond Chandler. Raymond Chandler came out of the pulps, you know, so he did it. But even those writers, with maybe the exception of Bradbury, but a lot of those writers, they didn't do it every sentence, you know.
Right.
So if you're going to do it, minimize it. And think about the ones you use. If you use replied, it kind of works. A person can reply to something. But if you see reply later down the road, it'll stand out. Said doesn't. Because if I'm telling you a story, I say, he said. You don't get people telling you stories saying, you know what, we were talking and he replied enthusiastically to me. And then I responded, you know, in such a way. You don't do that. So my clue was always, how are people really talking? I may not be able to duplicate that or want to duplicate it exactly, but I want to give the impression of real speech. That's how I finally came to that conclusion, is that if you're telling me a story, I have never heard anybody say, you know, I'm sure there's a person out there once in a while said I've replied to that, but I have never heard anybody say I grunted that to him and he growled that back to me. So there's your clue already.
Mm-hmm. That's part of what some people consider their style. How can you tell?
Well, if it is, it is. Yeah, I mean, right. I'm not certainly trying to not tell anybody what, mm-hmm, you know, to not do it, yeah, because I don't. I'm merely saying that these are my feelings about it, mm-hmm, and what works for me may not be your thing. But to me, that's not style. That's not style. That's a tag. Style is, and this isn't completely, it was about 10 o'clock in the morning with the sun not shining and a hard, wet look of rain in the foothills. Raymond Chandler opening for The Big Sleep. I think I left out a little piece, mm-hmm, in there. But that's style.
Right.
Not he growls. How's that part of your style?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a tag.
Is it important for a writer to be a part of like writers' groups or have somebody else?
For some people, it is. I mean, and I've been a part of one, but I never felt once that it ever helped me.
Really?
But you know, that doesn't mean it won't help someone else. The only thing I think about writers' groups, and I guess you're talking about getting together with a bunch of writers and reading stories and talking about
Just to have someone else look at your work.
Got somebody whose opinion you care about, that's fine. But what I find is that most of those groups are other people who don't know what they're doing telling you what to do.
Oh, absolutely.
And then they have the story. You're not writing the story they want. And, you know, I remember reading stories that shocked people so much that they would just go, oh, God, I would never write that. Well, I didn't ask you to. Did I do what I meant to do, not what you meant to do? And then other times I was there and I was the only one selling. And, you know, and I would give the best advice I could. And I think that if you're getting advice from writers who are selling, it's worth it. But if you just got a group of people and they just keep coming back with the same damn stories, or they keep coming back with the same similar stories, or they keep feeling the same or making the same mistakes, and they're telling you what to do, I just don't think it helps you much. I also think you begin to have a reliance on those people, and it's a crutch. And again, I'm not saying it's always bad, and I'm saying it depends on maybe who's in that group. But I have never been a part of a group I thought helped. Sometimes if you want to be part of the Western Writers of America or the Horror Writers Association, that's different because it's a collective idea more than it's a criticism of your work. There are other idiots trying to do what I'm doing, and they know markets. I was always more interested in where the market was. I didn't care what they thought. Right. The only person I cared thought was me and then the editor.
The person who was going to put the name on the check.
The person going to put the name on the check. And, you know, people say, oh, you write for money. You're damn straight, but I write for love. I wouldn't do this. I mean, of all the stuff I had to go through, I could have been, you know, a professor or something and had a steady job and shown up every week. Now, for the last 25 years, I've been quite in the clover. But that doesn't mean tomorrow that I will be. This thing can change overnight. And I went for years, you know, just working all kinds of jobs and just living at the bone level to do it. So I don't just do it for the money. I do it because I truly, dearly don't know how to do anything else that I love. And this is the greatest life in the world.
And you've put in the work to get to this.
I have
point.
Put
you've,
in the work.
You've lived through the
I have,
hard times.
Absolutely.
What are some of the other things that you see from other writers? You see that and you think that could be better. I mean, what kind of mistakes do you see in people trying to get into the business?
You mean the business aspects of it or the writing aspects?
Let's start with the writing aspects.
Well, you know, that depends. Sometimes you can read a sentence by someone that makes perfect sense, but it just doesn't work. That's the sort of thing where you can't really help somebody because it just doesn't have any pizzazz. And there's other things, too, that people that write very, very cleanly, but the words don't excite me. And I, you know, I'm not setting myself up as a bastion of style. I'm merely saying that I'm at least successful to this point. This is what works for me. You have to find what works for you. But it's good to listen to a variety of different opinions. And there are people who have absolutely the other end of the spectrum than I do. But I think one of the things is that people, they overwrite. They overwrite's one of the biggest ones I've seen, that they just tell too much. Or they start the story way too early. Enter in as late as possible and exit as early as possible. That's how you do a good story or a novel or a screenplay, for that matter. Mm. Enter in late, exit early.
How about the getting into the business? The business has probably changed a lot in the last.
The business is people are too goddamn lazy to do it. That's what I see. I'm probably the thing I'm most fed up with is that people who will come to me and say, "Well, you know, what do I do?" And I say, and I'll give them some tips, and then I'll see them 6 months later, and I'm trying to get. I just hadn't had any luck. What did you do? I didn't do any of those things. You know, so don't come back and ask me again. I mean, I may not know the answers, but why ask me? Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not going to try these things. And most people are too lazy to market. They can't stand rejection. And so they just eventually just put it on e-books or of their own. You know, I don't mean a regular e-book company. Or they publish it themselves because they have no faith in what they're doing. And then they end up selling 20 copies out of the trunk of their car or 100 copies on the email. Or ebooks rather, and to me, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm in ebooks. I'm in everything. I would even publish my own book, but I've at least earned the position and the chops to say if I publish it, I've at least I know what I'm doing. I may not know what I'm doing on the level to please everyone. You know, I'm not trying to be universally admired here.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that people don't give it that don't give it a real shot. That's the thing I find that bothers me the most. They just immediately go straight to the easiest, lowest common denominator possible. And they also write at the lowest common denominator because they know, well, I don't may not be able to learn this, but I'll just put it online and get rich. And you read about people who put things online and they get rich. But the reason you read about it is it's so damn rare. You know, it's not that it can't happen, but it doesn't necessarily mean the books are good or bad, but it doesn't mean just because you're going to publish an ebook or publish your own book, you're going to get wealthy. And in fact, the odds are against you.
It doesn't sound like you're a fan of going that route, the ebook, without getting a major publisher.
Well, I think for somebody like me that's been around and has a name, I can write it. I would write an original ebook, I think, if I wanted to. I haven't done that yet, but I can see myself doing that. But the difference is I'm not somebody that's unknown that's just throwing it. That's like rolling up a message, putting it in the bottle, and throwing it in the ocean and hope somebody sees it. And I think even for name writers and stuff, because there's so much out there, much of it the crap that these people are throwing out there, it's harder to sift through the stuff to find something that's worth reading.
Yeah.
But if you have a name and a reputation, well, somebody knows your name, even if it's not the general public. There's a group of the public or a portion of the public that knows they like Joe Lansdale's stories. They don't care whether this was published on ebooks or what, if it's a good story. But I've earned the right by having been published for, you know, 30-something years, nearly 40 years.
Is it, with all the options out there now, is it easier or harder to get published than it used to be? And does that mean as much as it used to?
There's an old thing that was told to me when I first started, and I can't remember who told it to me, but I think it was an old pulp writer. He said, anytime you start, it's the hardest time. Mm-hmm. You know, and right now, I think that it's, in some ways, it is the most exciting because of the ebooks and things, because there are now starting to be companies that actually have editors that buy for ebooks. It's not just you doing it yourself. It's always good to have that other. That's what I'm talking about. It's not the method that I'm fussing about. It's the idea that everybody just, you know, gets their own little file and
that it's a fallback.
It's a fallback.
Going through the channels,
so, yeah. So. If you earn your spot or you're really good and you find that's the method you want, I'm all for it. So I don't want to be misunderstood in that area. But I'm just saying most people don't try to do anything with publishing. And even if they do an ebook, they don't necessarily have it proof. They don't, and it can be the most awful, dreadful thing out there. So they don't really give themselves a chance, you know. Mm-hmm. So to me, in many ways, it's more exciting because I don't think books are going anywhere. I think that that when you look at ebooks now, that's the new paperback, mm-hmm. And there's a lot more room for that paperback. And a lot of people I know that used to not read will buy books. Usually they're by known authors, though. I'm back to that again.
Yeah.
But not absolutely. But usually they're by known authors. But now they're buying 10 books a year or 30 books a year where they used to buy one. Mm-hmm. Because it's just so easy for them to do it. For me, I don't see the big difference in that respect because I'm used to buying books.
Right.
But for them, it is. And if you have a small place and you love books and you don't have room to keep them, now you've got a whole library in one little box.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Do you have one?
I have one. I've used it three times. My wife's used it once or twice, and I have a Nook. But I still prefer. It's like my wife said, "You'll do anything but pick up that Nook," and she's right. I'll pick up books and read them for me, it's something that if I travel or if I wanted to go someplace, I didn't want to rough up a copy of a book I had, which I've done many times by carrying them on a plane to get home. They're all dog-eared, and you know. So there are advantages to it.
For the people who ask for advice from you, how important is it for them to understand not just what they're writing,
right,
but where that's going to go, what market, who it's going to go for?
Well, I'm mixed on that because I feel like when I first started out writing for markets, I had trouble selling. But when I started writing for me, not only the fact that I had more experience as I wrote more, that'd be the more important.
Yeah.
But when I started just writing for me, I started kind of finding the markets, and the markets actually come to me more because they know what I do. A lot of them will come to me and say, "We just want a Lansdale story." So I write a Lansdale story. Mm-hmm. And if there's nothing wrong with gearing something to market unless you gear it to such an extent it's not what you want to write. That's the trick. You know, if you should never try to sell yourself as a mystery writer, science fiction writer, a fantasy writer, a Western writer. You should sell yourself as a writer, and preferably take your last name, mine's Lansdale, and say you're the Lansdale genre or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you're that genre. Because if you develop that kind of attitude, because as soon as you're writing mysteries and that particular market plays out, you're out in the cold. I've seen it happen to a number of writers I know, and some of them very good friends, and they only, you know, had interest in that one thing. And of course, if you do, you do. But a lot of times they didn't think that that train would ever get off the track. And when that happened, I just moved over to comics for a while. Then I would move back when that came back. But in a way, it's kind of a combination of riding to market and flowing to market. I think of it more as flowing to market, because I don't really ever stop too much and think about, I'm going to write for this market, you know, because it always seems to be there now, thank goodness. But I earned that spot.
Right.
So I don't say that with any, you know, great amount of pride. I just say it with reality, that I earned that spot to where there's usually a place I can put the stories or the books, thank goodness.
Does it feel good when they say, you know, I need a Lansdale story?
It does feel good, a Lansdale story. I mean, it's not like the old days when I had to deal with rejections and things.
Do you remember those days? Do you remember the rejections?
Very
slips?
Well. I'll never forget them. I never really got depressed with rejection slips. I would get disappointed, but they just fired me up. And I literally, my wife and I joke about that old thing about having enough to paper room. I literally did have. And we actually did a limited edition book, a couple of them that were done for Subterranean, where I put a reject in every limited edition. We had a reject in each one of them. And I'll never forget those days. I'm not somebody that forgets where I came from.
Is that part of the process? Because you say you don't seem to have a lot of respect for people who aren't willing to put themselves out and risk that rejection.
I don't have, you know, and I think that that's part of what makes you the writer you are. And I think that's part of what, you know, allows you to earn that position and be proud. You know, if you can type up anything with nobody to say good or bad and publish it, then you haven't achieved anything, unless that's just so wonderful that it just changes the way people live and write, or you have a tremendous group of passionate fans. That usually doesn't happen. It usually doesn't happen even when you sell it to a but you have that opportunity to have to battle against it a little bit. You know, I wouldn't want to have to fight like I did when I started, but I didn't deserve to be where I am now when I started.
Mm-hmm. You've earned that.
I've earned it.
Yeah. We talked about agents earlier, agents and publishers. What goes into getting their attention? What do you need to do as an up-and-coming writer to...
Well, it goes back to that book. You have that book. It also goes back to if you have publications or short publications, because agents don't usually do that anyway. Mm-hmm. Very few agents handle short stories. You know, you might have the writer that writes maybe one or two a year, and or one or two every now and again, not even a year, and the agent might begrudgingly handle it. But my agent doesn't want to handle short stories, and I make a tremendous amount of money, and I get to write a tremendous amount of things I really want to do by doing that. So if you have those short story chops, that's one of the best tools to get an agent's attention.
So there you go. There's the great Joe R. Lansdale. I hear it, readaboutit.com. Special thanks to Joe for taking an hour out of his day to talk to me and help me and hopefully help other writers as well. Very honest, very forthcoming guy. I really appreciate that, because that's when you want help, that's what you want. You want somebody who's honest, and Joe was very nice about it, the whole thing. Thanks to Joe and his family as well for helping out. And thanks to you for listening, folks. We'll be back. We've got more interviews with more writers, more podcasts, more good stuff coming up for you this year in 2012 as we all work our way towards our goals. Thanks to Joe for starting us off on the right foot. Until next time, thanks for listening, everybody. Thank you. Drive through.